You're listening to the Operational Maritime Law Podcast, presented by the NATO Center of Excellence for Operations in Confined and Shallow Waters, headquartered in Kiel, Germany. To learn more, please visit coecsw.org.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Operational Maritime Law Podcast. I'm James Cook, and for this episode, I'll be speaking with Commander Caroline Tuckett. Not only is she one of my favorite people to work with, she is also a brilliant operational lawyer and one of the leading experts in the laws pertaining to uncrewed military vessels. As it happens, Commander Tuckett is also one of the busiest people I know, but I was lucky enough to catch up with her virtually and look forward to sharing that conversation with you shortly. But first, some more about our guest. Commander Tuckett joined the Royal Navy as a logistics officer in 2006 after having read Latin and ancient history at the University of Edinburgh. Her first assignments in the Royal Navy were in HMS Nottingham and then HMS Argyle as the Deputy Logistics Officer, with deployments to the South Atlantic, South America, and the Mediterranean. Upon completion of 3 years training to qualify as a barrister, her first legal assignment back in the service saw her in an advisory role where the range of offenses went from minor disciplinary action up to murder. From there, she went on to become the legal advisor to 3 Commando Brigade Royal Marines, covering a portfolio of both disciplinary matters and operational law, with a couple of deployments to the Mediterranean as part of Operation Cougar. An assignment in subunit command in HMS Sutherland followed, predominantly spent on national tasking conducting anti-submarine patrols. In 2018, Commander Tuckett deployed to the United Kingdom Maritime Component Command, that's UKMCC, in Bahrain as the legal advisor for both UKMCC and the Combined Maritime Force. Providing legal advice to the UK elements and a coalition of 32 nations, she advised on over 100 counter-narcotics boardings in 9 months. During this period, she also worked closely with the U.S. Navy JAG Corps in 5th Fleet. In 2020, Commander Tuckett became the lead legal advisor in international and operational law within the Royal Navy. A current focus of her work is the applicability of international maritime law to the military operation of uncrewed vessels. She has recently completed a master's by research in international law through the University of Exeter, exploring the legal issues of sub-threshold operations in the maritime environment. We are very pleased to welcome to the show Commander Caroline Tuckett. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, I mean, it is always a pleasure to get to talk to you and, of course, to learn from you. I'll just let listeners know that the first time I met you was when you were teaching the NATO School Oberammergau course in Crete, on operational maritime law. And you had this really funny habit of calling on me to answer questions that I should have known the answer to, but didn't. So it is a particular pleasure today to be the one asking the questions of you.
Oh, this is revenge. I didn't realize this was a giant revenge.
It could be construed as that, though I'm sure that unlike me, you are going to give some thoughtful, well-informed answers, even if I start randomly asking you rules from the coal regs.
Hey, if you make the mistake of sitting in my eye line, you're going to get asked questions.
So I just listed off your resume prior to our little intro here, but I hope that before we get into the nitty-gritty of autonomous shipping, which is what I really want to talk to you about today, that you can just clue us all in on how it is that one becomes a legal advisor in the Royal Navy in the first place. And then personally, why is it that you decided to go that route?
Oh, wow. Okay. So the Naval Legal Services in the Royal Navy is quite unique in that we recruit entirely from within. So you have to join as a military officer in a branch first. I joined as a logistics officer. And then you go through a selection process and you then get paid to go back to university, which I can thoroughly recommend. The reason we do it that way is because we want our lawyers to have military experience and background, because we find it's much easier to advise commanding officers and admirals if you've spent some time at sea. It also means we get employed in dual roles. So I'm in legal roles at the moment, but I could in theory go back to logistics roles at a later date.
So if you're already a lawyer, let's imagine you're a law student who's listening to this podcast and going, wow, if I'm a legal advisor in the Royal Navy, I can work with autonomous shipping. Would that actually, is there a process there for people who already are lawyers that want to do that?
Absolutely. I mean, they would still need to join the Royal Navy as, for example, a logistics officer and do their time in logistics, but it just means the training pipeline is much shorter. And we do have a few Navy lawyers who did their legal qualifications before they joined the services. So yeah, that route is definitely open.
all of you future legal advisors out there, there is a path for you in the Royal Navy. This is not a sponsored podcast.
But anyone who wants to come talk about autonomy would be very welcome.
Well, let's get into that. So I know you're dealing heavily with autonomy right now in your current position as the lead legal advisor in international operational law within the Royal Navy. Could you talk about what some other things are that find their way into your portfolio?
Oh, so my portfolio is full of the weird and the wonderful. If I look at, I've got my inbox open in front of me. So in my inbox at the moment, I have a query about wreck protection and protecting a Royal Naval wreck that dates back to the 1680s. I also have some queries about updating our operating orders to help warships when they're dealing with mariners in distress. So it's basically everything that affects naval and Royal Marine operations. And one minute I can be working in the 1680s, and the next minute I can be looking at the future of autonomous weapon systems way off into the future.
Certainly never a dull moment, I'm sure. And all the more reason to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and talk with us. So as I mentioned before, we want to talk about military operation of autonomous shipping and some of the legal challenges that are faced, not just by the Royal Navy. You mentioned before we started recording that you were in Malaysia recently. So a lot of countries are having to grapple with these problems that result from, is it fair to characterize this as new technologies pushing up against, you know, aging laws and conventions?
Yeah, I think it's not the first time that militaries around the world have had to deal with new technology and current law, but particularly with autonomous shipping, as we will get into, maritime law is written assuming that there is a crew on board. And so it is finding a way of operating shipping that has no crew in a manner that is still lawful is the big challenge.
Yeah. So I guess I'll frame it like this. When you hear someone use the term autonomous shipping, what do you think of?
So firstly, I'm very happy if they use the phrase autonomous shipping as opposed to uncrewed or unmanned shipping, because the phraseology itself is not even fixed, and this is half the debate. So autonomous shipping for me is a ship or a vessel which in some form can operate without full human control. Yeah. The International Maritime Organization has issued guidance giving 4 degrees of autonomy. And so it's important to note that even if we call something autonomous, it's not necessarily a robot ship that wakes up one morning and decides to take itself off on patrol. It could be a vessel that is operated by remote control. So the crew are on land and they're driving it in the way you might drive something on your Xbox or your PlayStation. Or it could be a vessel that is operating entirely autonomously, with minimal human intervention.
Okay. And you mentioned that the IMO has laid out these different grades. Can you kind of just walk us through what the different degrees are? And then, like you mentioned, fully autonomous. So if I recall right, that's degree 4.
That's right.
Do those even exist yet? Or is this, we're just kind of thinking about in the future?
Not to my knowledge or that's been declared.
Okay.
So degree 1 is a ship that has automated processes and decision support. So that's many complex warships that exist today in many NATO nations. We have ships with automated weapon systems and firefighting systems, for example. And so it's got a crew on board with some automated operations. Degree 2 is when the ship is remotely controlled, but you've still got the crew on board. And that's, we use degree 2 quite a lot in the Royal Navy at the moment, effectively to test the remote control software, but keep the crew on board for safety reasons while we go through the experimentation. Degree 3 is when you have a remotely controlled ship, but no seafarers on board. And we have operated a vessel in degree 3. So crew stayed on land, ship went over the horizon, and they were still operating it effectively from a laptop. And then degree 4 is a fully autonomous ship. So the ship is able to make its own decisions and determine actions by itself. Certainly from a naval perspective, we're not quite there yet. I think the civilian world is getting closer. But I think the key thing to remember is that these degrees, they're not fixed. And so different companies and navies are developing systems where you might, for example, use degree 3 to remotely drive it out the harbour, then put it into degree four to go on patrol, and then bring it back to degree three to bring it back in. So the vessels can move up and down the degrees.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm sure there's a lot of legal nuance to whatever degree that they're in, right? I mean, is degree one device going to be treating the same, the legally speaking, as a degree four one? There's a lot of different questions to answer, I guess.
There's a lot to unpack. So yeah. I think certainly the Royal Navy's approach has been that no matter what degree you are in, you will follow the law. The difficulty comes in how you interpret the law when nobody's on board. So if you've got a degree one ship, so it's a ship with a crew on board but some automated processes, that's relatively simple because the ship has either a commanding officer or a master, which is what things like UNCLOS and SOLAS and different maritime conventions talk about. The key thing, though, I think, is that it all comes down as to whether your autonomous system is a ship or not. Because the legal conventions out there apply to ships and vessels. And many navies will talk about autonomous vehicles or autonomous boats or autonomous equipment. So it comes down to what is a ship.
Okay. And I want to unpack that a little bit more in a second, but what are some of the key challenges more broadly that you face or that you try to grapple with as a legal advisor when it comes to autonomous shipping?
Broadly, it comes to the overarching question of, do we apply current international treaties to these systems or not? And you know, the UK is a firm supporter of UNCLOS, and we want to uphold it and support it where we can. And so the presumption is we will follow those treaties and conventions. But as a lawyer, you've obviously got to back that up with a credible argument. And certainly for my operators that I'm advising, they will not want to know why I'm saying to them they have to follow the Safety of Life at Sea Convention, for example.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. So you talked earlier about, you know, what do we call it? Is it a ship? Is it a crewed vessel, uncrewed vessel? How does calling it one thing over another?
Why do we care? What's in a name?
Yeah.
Okay. So firstly, I just want to quickly apologize. If anyone can hear snoring, it's my dogs in the background who are thoroughly bored with autonomy and have decided to take a nap. So, we care because of the application of the law. So I'll give you an example. The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea says all ships have the right to innocent passage in the territorial seas of a coastal state. So that's Articles 18 and 19. So if a navy is operating a vessel that we think may need to go into the territorial seas of another state under the regime of innocent passage, it needs to be a ship or a vessel to have that privilege. So whether it's a ship or not really matters. The difficulty we have is that there is no one single definition of ship in international law, which absolutely blew my mind when I realised this. UNCLOS talks about ships and vessels interchangeably. In the French version, the single word navire is used, and in Spanish it's buque. I've probably pronounced that totally wrong. We don't have a definition. We don't have a definition of what an actual vessel is. There are at least 13 different definitions out there. I stopped counting at 13. I hit my wall. But to give you an example, a vessel is defined in COLREGS as every description of watercraft, including non-displacement craft, winging ground craft, and seaplanes, used or capable of being used as a means of transportation on water. That's the definition that people cite the most often. But then the International Convention for the Prevention of Pollution from Ships, or MARPOL, says a ship is a vessel of any type whatsoever operating in the marine environment. So the definitions are not fixed. If we go to UK domestic law, they talk about the Merchant Shipping Act just says a vessel is... or a ship is any vessel which is used in navigation. So it's trying to work out if something is a vessel or not. And we have taken the view that because there is no one fixed definition, there's a freedom in that. And so we do have some autonomous systems that don't even look like vessels, but have been registered as such because they are used in navigation.
I see. So kind of a better safe than sorry policy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So ultimately, the reason that the status of these vessels is so important is because, as you mentioned, there's certain navigational rights and privileges that are tied to each. And I'm thinking of things like sovereign immunity. So yeah. If it's a vessel, is it a warship? Is it a, what are some of the other categories of things it could be aside from just a vessel?
So you're absolutely right. As well as navigational rights, there are other privileges attached to it. And from the military perspective, the one that we're really interested in is sovereign immunity. So under UNCLOS articles 95, 96, and 32, warships and other government ships have sovereign immunity, which means they are immune from the jurisdiction of any other state other than their own flag state. So I like to think of it as like it's like a bubble of protection that goes around our vessels as they sail around the world, and they shouldn't be boarded or interdicted by other nations. This is a really important principle for a military to have. But in UNCLOS, the principle of sovereign immunity is articulated in such a way that it says warships have sovereign immunity, or ships owned or operated by the state have sovereign immunity. So it goes all the way back to this basic point of what is a ship. And then you mentioned about warships. The third piece of the puzzle is belligerent rights. Under customary international law, only warships have belligerent rights or the ability in law to use offensive action. And so if we wanted to use a vessel in offensive action, for example, kinetic strike or enforcing blockades, then it would need to be designated as a warship. So it had the right nomenclature in law.
Yeah. And as you mentioned before, the UK is taking the position that we're going to register all these vessels that are being operated by our Navy as warships. Is that correct?
Or so at the moment, ours are registered as government vessels. We're not yet at the stage where we've registered any as warships. This is a developing technology. And to my knowledge, and I'm very happy to be proved wrong, no Navy has registered an autonomous warship. What has happened is that the UK has made a public statement through an inquiry that went through the House of Lords to say that we believe that in law you can have autonomous warships. And so we've set up the position so that should we develop the technology in the future, we can do it. And the US Navy has recently published their guidance to commanders on the law of maritime operations, and they've followed the same position. But it took a bit of work and a bit of legal analysis, because the definition of a warship under UNCLOS Article 29 includes the fact that a warship should be commanded by a commissioned officer and manned by a crew subject to service discipline, which implies that they're on board. But the UK has taken the view that actually they could be ashore.
I have to think that we can treat this similar to how we treat UAVs, where the person in control can be on another ship. They can be in a container box in the middle of Nevada. Is there anything within the current law that says that no, that's actually not the case?
No. So the current law is silent, really. And I think so the aircraft example is a really interesting one. Firstly, I'm quite jealous of the aviation world, because an aircraft is defined in the Chicago Convention, whereas a ship
must
is not
be nice.
Defined. Yeah, it's nice, right? How easy is that? So lucky them. So I'm going to get shot down literally now by aviation lawyers. So whereas in UNCLOS, a ship, as we've said, is not defined. And the first two words in the definition of a warship is it is a ship. But there is parallel with aviation. And I think the key thing that we argued to the Secretary of State for Defence in the United Kingdom was that the whole purpose of providing a definition of a warship in UNCLOS Article 29 is to ensure state responsibility and accountability. Those definitions are in there to show that that vessel, should it act in a way that is unlawful, there is a line of accountability through the crew, through the commissioned officer in command, all the way up to the government that owns and operates it. And so our view was that we should interpret that treaty to include, once the technology is there, autonomous warships as well.
So even after we deal with all these problems of what to call it and how to register it and how to classify it, we still have a second challenge here, which is how do we now operate this vessel lawfully, regardless of what it's named? As someone who at one point in my life has had to memorize the coal regs or the...
And you were really good when I asked you point blank in that class. So, you know, it clearly worked.
Yep. I definitely was not reading it straight out of the book when you asked me that. I seem to recall some pieces in there that might be challenging for autonomous vessels to comply with. So I'll just ask you, do the coal regs still apply to uncrewed vessels? You say the Royal Navy's taking the position that yes, they do.
Yeah. So you're right that having got over the challenge of what do we call them and do we make them ships or not, the next challenge has been how do we operate them? And so the way I've discussed this with the operators is that with the rights and privileges of being called ships, which I know you're all very pleased about, you also now have certain obligations, including things like sticking to the coal regs. So first point, we've said we've taken the view, if we have an autonomous system that is registered as a vessel on our defence shipping register, then because it is a vessel, it not only has things like freedom of navigation rights, but it also has obligations to follow things like coal regs. Mm. But then you get to the point about how do you apply them? And I think the rule that I was so cruelly asked you to talk about in Crete was rule five, which is a really good example where international law has been written with a human in mind. So rule five says that every vessel shall at all times maintain a proper lookout by sight and hearing, as well as by all available means in the prevailing circumstances and conditions, so as to make a full appraisal of the situation and the risk of collision. So the issue there is that the rule talks about the need for a proper lookout by sight and by hearing. So we had a look at this and we thought, how do we apply this to the regulations? And what we've developed for the Royal Navy is what we're calling the principle of equivalence. So the idea is that if we register an autonomous vessel on our defence shipping register, we have developed a testing software that's effectively like a bridge simulator for the vessel. And the idea is that provided the autonomous vessel can demonstrate it's got the same amount of situational awareness as an officer of the watch on the bridge, it's got to be at least the same or better, then we are meeting rule five. And the thought process behind that was, if you look at the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, it says that treaties should be interpreted in light of their normal meaning and purpose. And you've got to interpret it in good faith, and that's Article 31. So if we look at Rule 5, the meaning and the purpose of Rule 5 is for everyone to keep a good lookout to avoid collisions. So provided the operators of the autonomous vessel can show that they've got systems on board that achieve the same aim, then we are happy to assess that it is compliant with Rule 5. And that, I mean, that's just one practical example.
I mean, it's encouraging to hear you say that, because in a lot of the literature that I've read about some of the legal quandaries posed by autonomous vessels, it seems to me that a lot of hay has been made by people who are way too quick to say, oh no, we're not in compliance with coal regs or SOLAS because of things like Rule 5. Mm. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think there's plenty of precedent out there for ships that are currently operating totally reliant, or at least mostly reliant, on technology to actually be their eyes and ears. And yes, there's a human in the loop and that's on board and they can pull out the binoculars. But for a lot of these really huge vessels, I mean, and even these solo racing yachts, the technology that we have on board these things is far superior to what we might get from, you know, sending someone to go stand outside in the rain and listen for fog signals. And so I guess I'll just kind of preempt a SOLAS question here. My take, and correct me here if I'm wrong, is that there's a line in SOLAS that says something to the effect of, like, which is in position to provide assistance, right? Like, that's the qualifier for if you must provide assistance. Seems to me pretty definitive in giving crewless vessels a pass on being able to render assistance to a crewed vessel in that same capacity as another crewed vessel. Am I being too dismissive of these types of arguments?
Like, no, you're actually right. I think the SOLAS argument is in the absence of express guidance in international law, which we're hoping to get from the IMO in 2028, we're trying to apply common sense to this as a military. And so with the SOLAS one, as you've alluded to, I mean, UNCLOS talks about the master of a ship trying to render assistance to people, and SOLAS Regulation 33 talks about the master being in a position to be able to provide assistance. So we have approached this almost, again, in terms of a guiding principle. And this is where the degrees of autonomy come in. So let's say you've got a vessel that you're operating in degree three. So you're operating it remote controlled, but the crew are all ashore. If you have a camera feed on the front of that vessel and through that camera feed, you see mariners in distress in the water, then our approach has been that you would react in the same way you would react as if you were standing on the bridge. So you might not be able to physically lift them out of the water, but you will do what you can to assist where you can. And it might be something as simple as providing a phone call to the local Coast Guard, or positioning the autonomous wet vessel so it acts as a windbreak until further assistance arrives. But yes, you're right. In the treaties themselves are pretty practical. And in all cases, you know, SOLAS being a good example, it makes it very clear that if the master considers it unreasonable or unnecessary to go to the help of someone in distress, then that is okay, provided you've got a sufficient reason to do it. So it comes down to doing what you can in circumstances.
You've been involved, am I right, in some of the kind of design and engineering problems, or how would I say this? People come to you and say, oh, if we design it this way, are we going to be in compliance with the law? Uh-huh. Have you had a situation where you can think, well, these are people trying to do the right thing, but we're really complicating it here?
Yeah. I think the one that jumps out again is SOLAS. SOLAS doesn't just talk about rendering assistance in distress. It also talks about what life-saving equipment needs to be carried on board vessels. You know, and a lot of this was drafted and put into place following incidents like the Titanic. And so I did receive a phone call about an autonomous vessel was going to get tested. And there was a last minute panic because they realized it didn't have a life raft on board. And so the phone call I got was, well, it can't sail because it's not compliant with SOLAS. SOLAS says.
Was there a person on board?
There was nobody on board.
Oh.
So this vessel at the time, I could imagine a jet ski without a seat. It was literally a remote controlled jet ski without a seat. I don't know where they would have put the life raft. But it was an interesting example of how people are used to following the law, and quite rightly too, and it's very good to see, but then tie themselves in knots because they're like, well, how do we attach a life raft to this tiny autonomous bit of equipment? Now, what SOLAS actually says is you must have sufficient life-saving equipment per person on board. So the practical answer was to go back and just say, look, if there is no reasonable expectation of ever carrying people on this jet ski with no seat that nobody can sit on, then you don't need to worry about it carrying a life raft. But it was an example of where, with all the right intentions, there was nearly an effort to over-engineer a problem that was actually relatively simple to fix.
I mean, and we can too. I mean, we could poke fun at other people for trying to comply with these laws that seem kind of obvious to us to either apply or not apply. What are some of the real issues? So, I mean, I look at Rule 5 and I go, not a real issue. SOLAS, we kind of decided not a real issue. What are some of the real big issues that you think, wow, the IMO or somebody has to address this soon, or we're going to get into a problem here?
So I think at the moment we're in a relatively comfortable space because nobody, to my knowledge, is really going above degree 3. So in other words, most of the autonomous vessels out there that are labeled as autonomous tend to be remote controlled. There's a high degree of human intervention. Where it becomes more of a challenge is when we get fully autonomous vessels and how then we would apply something like obligations to render assistance in distress. You know, have we got software out there that's or technology that's clever enough to spot a swimmer in the water and realize they're in trouble and send back a message to say that they need help? That's the next thing. But I think tied in with that, the IMO have done a review of all the maritime conventions and have acknowledged that there needs to be effectively what they're going to call a maritime autonomy code. And this will try and fill the gaps. So where in UNCLOS it talks about a master's obligation to look after the ship and keep his crew safe, that needs to almost be effectively translated into how you would do it ashore. That's not going to come until 2028. So we're still operating in a bit of a gap at the minute.
And so, and up until now too, we've really only talked about peacetime navies and kind of civilian problems that face autonomous shipping. So let's kind of try and imagine a scenario here where these vessels might be used in armed conflict, or at least in a situation where force is used. You travel a lot. You've seen what a lot of other navies are doing up close and personal. So I'm just generally, I'm not asking you to give away any state secrets here.
I don't know anything.
Oh, what? What steps have you seen being taken out there that are put in place in order to ensure that these systems are complying with IHL principles in addition to UNCLOS?
So honestly, a huge amount of the focus at the moment has been on peacetime operations rather than how we operate them in conflict. Now, clearly, Ukraine has thrown up a lot of pertinent questions about the law of naval warfare and how they are used. I think at the moment, because no state has come out and declared, I've got an autonomous warship that can be used for kinetic strike, we're still slightly in the dark as to how we go. What I can tell you from the UK perspective is that as signatories to the additional protocols, the Geneva Conventions, we do Article 36 weapons reviews on all new military systems. So if we were to develop a system that could be used in conflict, that would go through a full legal review to make sure that it could be operated in compliance with both the Geneva Conventions and the law of naval warfare. That's where we are at the minute. I think what I would say is to try and plug that gap, the San Remo manual on the law of naval warfare, which many will be familiar with, is under review at the moment. And I represent the United Kingdom on the group that are putting together the revisions. And my task for 2023 is to put together a paper where we try and formulate some black letter rules regarding the operation of autonomous ships in conflict. So it's very much a work in progress. So I go back to my point about recruitment earlier. If anybody would like to join and talk about autonomy, I'd be delighted.
Well, here's another opportunity to pique some people's interest who aren't familiar with things like the San Remo manual. What role does this, we haven't done a podcast episode on that yet, but what role does this kind of soft law play in crafting the rules of the road here?
As in, what role does the manual play in crafting?
Yeah, so can you just kind of fill people in on what is the San Remo manual and what function does it serve?
So the San Remo manual was put together in 1994 by a group of international lawyers and military experts. And what it did was it collated together all the bits of law and state practice with regards to the law of naval warfare into one book, which you might think, I can't believe we didn't do that before, but no one had really done it before. And what it did was then look at the principles in law and from them derive effectively, they're called black letter rules, but very simple statements that people can follow. So a simple one would be, under the law of naval warfare, as a matter of customary international law, we know that a state can impose a blockade. And so the San Remo manual took that principle, turned it into a black letter rule, a state can impose a blockade, and then under the rule provided a commentary on state practice and how it's been done in the past and what the experts felt considered to be the appropriate way to follow that rule. It was really groundbreaking at the time. So it's now due a revision because 1994 was quite a while ago and technology has moved on. And so there are many areas to be revised, but one of them is the impact of autonomy. And within that, autonomous shipping.
We talked a little bit about some of the law that's out there that applies, UNCLOS, for instance, MARPOL. What are some of the other documents you would recommend people who are in this field to kind of get familiar with as they start doing more research or learning more?
Crikey.
Read papers by Caroline.
No, Tuckett. Don't read papers by me. That's a terrible idea. I think, this sounds really simplistic, but if you just Google autonomous vessels, all sorts of stuff comes up. Yeah. I think one of the key documents that we found of great use in the Navy is actually an industry document, which is available online. The UK has set up a group called the Maritime Autonomous Systems Regulatory Working Group, which I accept is quite a mouthful.
That's a great name.
It's a great name, isn't it? It's punchy. So they have issued a code of practice for industry to operate autonomous shipping. It's really good. I commend it to anyone who's interested because it just provides, if you like, the practical rules and guidance on how to operate autonomous shipping in an industry world, but there's a lot of it that we've used and translated across into the military. And it covers all sorts of areas, including things like safety of life at sea or cybersecurity, which is a key concern.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to check it out. And for listeners, we will put that in the show notes as well, so you can easily find it and you don't have to remember the name.
Yeah, it's not simple.
Making it easy.
Yeah. So I would recommend that.
Okay. And I just want to kind of clear up one thing. You mentioned kind of this gap right now that exists between when the IMO is expected to release some new guidance. It makes me wonder, what is being done in the meantime by nations that are looking to develop these technologies without any definitive legal guidance? And are there any risks associated with this process of just kind of make it up until the IMO tells us we're wrong?
Make it up, but use fancy legal jargon so we try and get away with it. So yeah, it's a great question because as anybody who practices in the law knows, generally international law is formed and from that you can derive domestic law to support it. We're in a sort of reverse situation at the minute. So the UK, by way of example, has decided we can't wait till 2028. So on the civilian side, the Department for Transport is drafting up domestic legislation that will, if passed, update our Merchant Shipping Act to include references to autonomous shipping. I know that France has already done that. They passed some domestic legislation last year with regards to operating autonomous shipping. Belgium, I think, has also passed some legislation, and many other European nations are doing the same. So it's a slightly weird situation where everybody is ploughing on ahead and waiting for the IMO to catch up. Now, that's not the IMO's fault. They are a huge international organisation. So trying to get international consensus on things like this is clearly very difficult. So I know that certainly from the UK perspective, what the Department for Transport are doing are talking very regularly with the IMO so that the IMO understand what we're doing so that nobody is caught out. But it all goes back to following the spirit and the intent of current international law. So everything that we draft and everything we put in place, both for the military and industry, is being done with the idea of supporting current international law and making it safe for mariners at sea.
Well, speaking of supporting current international law and making it safe for mariners at sea, what is next for Caroline Tuckett after this? What do you got on the horizon? We got San Remo Manual coming up. You've got a conference coming up.
We've got a conference coming up. I'd like to go back to Crete again. Can we do Crete again? That was fun.
Crete course, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
For all these of you interested who are associated with NATO or NATO member states, there is a annual NATO School Oberammergau NSO course on operational maritime law. You can go ahead and Google that too while you're Googling random industry notes.
Yeah, please come along to the course. It was really fun.
Okay. Well, hey, you've been really tremendous with your time. Thank you so much for making us all a little bit smarter on autonomous shipping, not to be confused with uncrewed shipping, as I so foolishly put in the title to my email to you. But thank you for correcting me.
We didn't even debate that, but it's fine. It's okay.
Well, thanks so much.
Okay. Bye.
The COE CSW is a leading NATO think and do tank focused on enhancing military capabilities to contend with the security challenges posed in the world's confined and shallow waters. As a reminder, the views expressed in this podcast are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the positions of NATO, the COE CSW, or any of the institutions to which the participants belong.